Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So Wednesday, December 5th is the day of mourning for Bush 41, President George Herbert Walker Bush, who passed away late Friday evening. But we'll take your reflections here this morning, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. How will you remember President Bush 41? How will you remember his presidency in terms of assessing it? We'll take your perspectives all morning.
Well, I wanted him to be more than a one-term president. I remember he was the first president that I voted for, Dan. And I'm a lot older than you, so who was your first president
that you voted for? My first president I voted for would be George Herbert Walker Bush in 1992.
Yeah. So I voted for him when he won. You jumped on board, and he lost.
Yes, correct.
But, I mean, we knew
Oh,
he did. No, that's right.
Yeah.
And the great thing about university.
I forgot how old I was.
Right. Jeez. It happens. Then you start eating Jell-O.
Yeah,
I went to University of Iowa, so they were all campaigning, and he spoke at our all-girls dorm, and he was funny. He came in, and there weren't a lot of us there, but a gig's a gig, you know, and Bab stood there very stoic, and, you know, you could just tell she was tired, had three strands on, and he was joking. He goes, well, ladies, since it's an all-girls dorm, I guess I can't go upstairs, so we'll just have this meeting here. And he spoke, it was just get out the vote rally.
Oh, Dad.
And he was vice president. It was cute.
Yeah, he's cute.
No, it was funny. I thought that was really cool. He seemed relatable, and I liked him.
I mean, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting life story. There's no question about it. Every president is. But certainly, coming from privilege.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know the Walker Cup in golf?
Yes.
That's named after his dad.
Oh, Prescott, or what's his name? Was it Senator Prescott?
Right.
Walker.
So he came from privilege, and he could have had a nice life in Connecticut and been a Wall Street financier. Instead, he goes off to war and becomes a war hero, a fighter pilot. Then he comes back and goes to Yale, captains the baseball team. Then instead of staying in the Northeast, he goes down to Texas and makes his fortune in oil and then launches his political career. So, you know, the one of the reflections I thought was a good one over the weekend from his many associates, all the people that worked for him during his political career, is that he didn't take the easy path. And so there's something that demands respect about that.
I did not know that he was the only one who survived when his airplane was shot down. There are two other people with him that didn't make it. And they have that footage of him being rescued. And it's just amazing that of all, you know, all the people that were, you know, in peril, they had footage of him.
Enlisted in the Navy on his 18th birthday, became the Navy's youngest commissioned aviator, compiling 126 carrier landings and 58 missions. That's serious business. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because all the great things that he did, they don't stand out as much as when the Democrats tried to paint him as a wimp when he was running against, I think it was Dukakis at the time. Here's a guy that was in an airplane, fought in the war, shot at, and all of the good stuff that goes with that, and they're trying to paint this guy as a wimp. I just don't get it, but I don't think it stuck, but that's what they tried to do.
Yeah.
It was shameful then, and it's shameful forever. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call, Ed. It was interesting to hear the reflections over the weekend, I thought in particular from James Baker, because, I mean, first of all, James Baker's 88. He's no spring chicken, but he's still whip sharp, and it was great to hear from him, number one. Number two, not just because he was Secretary of State and a close advisor to the president, because they were longtime friends, so he had great perspective. James Baker on with Chris Wallace this weekend.
In my view, and I would bet this is true with Dick Cheney as well, he was the very best one-term president this country's ever had, and perhaps one of the very best presidents of all time. But he didn't blow his own horn. One of his wonderful character traits was to let other people take credit. That was something he was brought up with, and that's the way he operated. But he was an extraordinarily, if you think about it, you go back and look at the record, he was an extraordinarily consequential president of the United States, particularly in the arena of foreign affairs.
Well, we'll get to assessment of his presidency, but I also wanted to offer up Baker's a characterization of his last moments, because James Baker and his wife were there.
Yeah, he had a very gentle and peaceful passing, Chris. Only one of his children was living in Houston, Neil Bush. Neil and his wife Maria were there. My wife Susan and I, his rector from our church, St. Martin's Church in Houston. The doctor, some of the wonderful aides that took care of him in his later years. And it was a sweet situation. They made arrangements for all of his children to call in to, in effect, tell him goodbye. And his last words, the last words George Bush ever said were, "I love you." And he said those words to 43, George Bush, President George Bush, 43, who had called in to say, "Dad, I love you. I will see you on the other side." And President Bush said, "I love you." And those were his last words.
I mean, it's it's heartbreaking, but it's part of life. But still, it doesn't make it any easier.
Yeah,
he was a fantastic man. He was a fantastic father, grandfather, great-grandfather. And the love of his life he gets to now spend time with for the rest of his life.
And it was interesting, too. Baker added this little note that I didn't see reported anywhere else, but Ronan Tynan was there, the great Irish tenor. Listen to this.
Another tender moment about that, Chris, was that the Irish tenor, Ronan Tynan, was in town. He'd come to town just to pay a courtesy call on President Bush, and he happened to be there, and he sang a couple of songs for President Bush on that last evening. And he said one of them was Silent Night. And as he was singing, President Bush was mouthing the words of Silent Night. He had a very gentle and easy passing, the kind we ought to all hope we have.
Yeah, pretty cool. And Ronan Tynan, you remember, he sort of became, I mean, he's an incredible classical musician. But after 9/11, Ronan Tynan was the guy who was singing God Bless America and the national anthem at Yankee Stadium. And that's how he really rose to international fame, or greater international fame, as the case may be. Robert in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I liked him for his humor. You know, like if you look up Dana Carvey impersonates the president at the Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about the life and legacy of President George Herbert Walker Bush. Steve on 88. Both Bush 41 and Barb had the decency to appear on The Simpsons. That's an important
part
of their legacy. I got a text from 708. Bush came to College of DuPage in 1988 along with Thompson, Jim. He was a good man, and politics weren't so polarized back then. Another text from 708. Seemed to be a good man, kind of an unremarkable president. And then Robert from Oak Brook, we had a little hiccup on our line there. His question was, had Bush not broken his pledge to read my lips, no new taxes?
That's the most overplayed soundbite in the world, but it is. And we got to hear it all again yesterday.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
Well, and the question was kicked around in some of the Sunday talkies, too. Had he not broken that pledge, would he have won re-election? And I'll let our friends and listening audience reflect on that, and we'll pick that up at 538
and
for President, your answers.
And President Trump was about to sit down with President Xi of China and spoke quickly.
There'll be spending 3 days of mourning and 3 days of celebrating a really great man's life. So we look forward to doing that, and he certainly deserves it.
And thank goodness he and Melania are going to the funeral.
It was funny, in the official statement from the president, he referenced the famous 1,000 points of light. In his words, President George Bush inspired generations of fellow Americans to be to a public service, to be, in his words, 1,000 points of light, illuminating the greatness, hope, and opportunity of America to the world. And you remember during the campaign, he lampooned 1,000 points of light. 1,000 points of light, what is that? What is that? So it's just interesting bringing that back in a different context because it's a different context.
This holiday season, we are asking you for your help, for your kind donations to help us feed 3,000 people in Haiti, provide food for a year and water for life. It's our annual campaign, and we're getting close, but we're asking for a one-time donation of $80, and we want you to call this number, 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-HOPE, or go to 560theanswer.com/food. Any donation would be appreciated, but again, we're asking for an $80 donation, which would provide food for a year and water for life for one child in Haiti.
And the other way to participate is through our business benefactor program, like so many great businesses in the Chicagoland area have already. Chris Jacobs, affiliated Century 21 in Algonquin, Matthew Hickey, attorney at law in Chicago, American Eagle, the web developers out in Des Plaines, and many others. If you want to participate in the same way those companies are, make a $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor. And in return for your generosity, we here at AM560 want to promote your business by giving you 40 60-second commercials that will run primetime hours in our broadcast day, Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. And the way to participate in that program is just call our sales manager. Her name is Anjanette, and her number 847-472-8951. Again, that's Anjanette at 847-472-8951, or you can go to our website, 560theanswer.com, and search the keyword food.
And speaking of Haiti, I mean, President Bush and President Clinton, they teamed up together after that horrific earthquake in 2010, and they really seemed to appreciate their relationship with each other. They raised millions of dollars, and I'll never forget the interview when somebody asked President Bush a gotcha question, and Bill Clinton gently leaned over and said, and shook his head like, don't go there. Don't answer it. He protected him, and I will never forget that.
That was a grope.
Oh, no, is that what?
Well, interesting, the relationship they had, starting with the letter.
Yeah, the letter that he left.
And this has been revisited over the weekend, the letter that George Herbert Walker Bush left for President Clinton when he entered the Oval Office on January 20th of 1993. The last line is the key. Your success now is our country's success. I'm rooting hard for you. And so they had lines of communication over, after that difficult campaign. And as you mentioned, worked together in some philanthropic endeavors as well. That, of course, Bill Clinton then teamed up with Hillary to turn into less than philanthropic ventures. I mean, I'm just saying.
No, it's true. Yeah.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Since I'd achieved all my goals as president in one term, there was no need for a second. The end.
The, awesome. The Simpsons version of the Bush presidency. Very good. This is getting a bit weird. First, Murphy Brown is back on the air.
Yeah.
And then Dan Quayle is back on the air this weekend.
What do you mean?
History is looping. Well, Dan Quayle was back on the air with Maria Bartiromo because, of course, he was President Bush's vice president.
Yeah, I remember right. Potato. Don't ask me how to spell it.
You
don't ask me.
But you know what's what was bizarre with respect to Dan Quayle? Not just that the juxtaposition with Murphy Brown. Dan Quayle was right. Remember that Atlantic headline? After all the ridicule he got for criticizing the Murphy Brown storyline, Dan Quayle was right about the nuclear family. You want to really feel old? Watch Dan Quayle on Maria Bartiromo and recall that you lived through him as an adult. Dan Quayle is 71 years old. Doesn't that's old.
Doesn't
he just, for some reason, I don't, maybe it's just me, he's always like 45 years old in my head.
Yeah.
You know, I just, seeing Dan Quayle 71 just makes.
Did he have gray hair? I missed it. I wish.
Not really.
I could Google him right now. Why don't I do that?
I mean, it just makes me feel real old, so I can't imagine what that does to you.
Oh, stop.
Dan Quayle, of course, reflecting on his relationship with President Bush, his time with President Bush. It was a really interesting interview. Here's Quayle on President Bush's legacy and accomplishments.
George Bush was, he's just absolutely the best. He was a great individual, in my opinion, a great president. He loved his family. He loved his work. He loved the country. And it was such an honor for me to work with him every single day that he was president and I was vice president for the American people. And a lot of folks, you know, they ask me, well, what's the legacy? I said, you know, that's a tough question. Historians will sort that out. But in my view, his legacy, Maria, was accomplishments. He got things done. When he left office, the economy was growing at 5-6%. You know, the Berlin Wall came down. Eastern and Central Europe freed from the yoke of communism. Apartheid in South Africa was eliminated. Success in putting Saddam Hussein back into Iraq. Noriega apprehended. So many things in a short period of time, and the domestic front as well. So accomplishments. He did so much in 4 years.
I agree with Dan Quayle. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Certainly he gets high marks for managing the end of the Cold War, for repelling Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. I know there's the criticism of not going on to Baghdad and toppling the regime at the time, but you know, sometimes restraint in these matters. It was an effective war, Gulf War One, in terms of its management and outcome.
Yeah, but he thought that Saddam Hussein would be pushed out by his people after they took back Kuwait, and that didn't happen.
Yeah, dictators never go quietly. And, you know, waiting for the revolution is sometimes waiting for Godot. But on the domestic front, we had this question posed to us by Robert from Oak Brook at the top of the hour. Would Bush have won? Did he not break his no new taxes pledge? You remember this? It's an instant classic from the 1988 convention.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips.
The applause died down when he, in fact, did raise taxes, did raise marginal rates. Would President Bush have won had he not done that? I think it's very difficult to say. Was that worth, you know, flipping 2.5 percentage points for him to beat Clinton? Because remember, it was like 40-38-19.
If Ross Perot wasn't in the race.
43-38-19, yeah.
Don't you think he would have won, Bush, if Ross Perot wasn't in the race?
For sure.
For sure. It was a fellow Texan, too. I mean, it was.
But here's the thing. One of the reasons that Ross Perot was in the race is because of President Bush's and the establishment Republicans' fecklessness. So it's kind of like, what, if you didn't cause this, would you have won? Well, sure. But you caused, you know, you were the beginning of your own demise because of the policy choices you made. So the whole kind of why did Ross Perot run in the first place? People kind of don't take people wanting to defend the legacy and wanting to say that that breaking a promise on taxes wasn't the proximate cause of his defeat. Well, it was in part at minimum. I mean, it's hard to know how an election would have turned out without something that seismic. It definitely hurt him. There's no question about that. So how much did it hurt him? I mean, it's hard to say. But it what gave rise to Ross Perot is what really hurt him. What gave rise to Ross Perot is what's hurt the Republican Party. I mean, Ross Perot was the sort of undisciplined populist before Donald Trump made it cool.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right. There are a lot of similarities between the two.
I mean, minus the Texas accent, they're saying a lot of the same things. Now, obviously, Trump, you know, more focused on the more salient issues of the day, issues that are more in people's mind today, the job loss, the global trade, globalism, versus America firsters, immigration. And Ross Perot was talking about debt and deficits mainly, because as Dan Quayle mentioned, even though the economy hadn't been sort of officially declared out of recession, it was starting to grow and people were starting to feel good about it. So it's just very interesting to think about that, what gave rise to Ross Perot and what's the lesson learned there? Because there's your reaction to the decisions people in power make. For example, George Bush breaking his pledge on taxes gave rise to Newt Gingrich.
And then the
Gingrich Revolution in 94.
Someone just texted into the show that, or emailed me, sorry, saying that him saying no new taxes is similar to Obama saying you can keep your doctor.
It really was. It was the sort of you could keep your doctor before you could keep your doctor, because it was such a seminal line. And
well, it was believable. I mean, I felt for it. I fell for it both times.
Well, it was a seminal line, and it was, a seminal betrayal. So, the interesting thing is, and a lot of people remarked upon at the time, me being one of them, always was skeptical of George Herbert Walker Bush, because of the primary he ran in 1980 against Ronald Reagan, where he referred to supply side economics as voodoo economics.
Uh oh.
And so, you know, if somebody says that, it's one thing, you know, you spar and there's name calling and there's disagreements on policy. It's another thing when somebody says, you know, your philosophy, here's my comment on your philosophy. Okay, well, now I know where you stand. And so Bush was a dutiful vice president and Ronald Reagan passed the torch. But I never forgot that line, and I think a lot of supply-siders never forgot that line, and so they were less surprised that Bush was willing to compromise away his commitment not to raise taxes for the purpose of getting a budget done at the advent of the Gulf War. Needed a budget done, needed authorization of use of force to repel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. Just interesting. Rather than just looking at these decisions that are made in isolation, look at them in context, you know, the fluidity of history, and see how one connects to the other, and decisions that are made give rise to particular consequences. I just think that's more interesting. Speaking of that fluidity and continuity, I thought Quayle's remark here about Reagan to Bush to Quayle was really interesting.
He had been vice president for 8 years, and he knew the good things about being vice president and the not so good things about being vice president. So that was a blessing from my perspective. But what he said to me on the steps of the Capitol, as we said goodbye to Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan, he turned to me and in sort of his, you know, low voice, he says, "That man was very good to me." And I can say that today, that man, George Bush, was very good to me.
Aww.
I like that. I mean, I like that continuity and just sort of whatever the personal disagreements are. The positions are so important. It's a sort of a hat tip, I think, to an understanding that being in those positions is not about you and your self-aggrandizement. It's about the job that you have to do on behalf of this great nation. So I'm so glad that Dan Quayle shared that.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
I know you always get sucked into the love story aspect. You're still weepy over the Bill and Hillary meeting in the Yale Law Library. So you wanted to connect George Herbert Walker Bush to his dearly departed wife, Barbara.
And you know what? Since they were so attached, married for 73 years, the longest married couple in the White House. Since she passed away, 3 months ago, I thought that he would follow a few weeks later, but he didn't. They met when they were 18 at a Christmas dance, and she can describe it best.
I could hardly breathe. I thought he was so beautiful.
He took her breath. Well, he did. And then he went off to war.
That was the song they danced to.
Yes. He went off to war, and communicated via love letters only.
I love you, precious, with all my heart. And to know that you love me means my life. Little did I know I was only trying to keep up with Barb Pierce from Onondaga Street in Rye, New York. Oh, I love you.
I love you, too.
They're so sweet. I mean, she seemed like the strong one. Whenever he would get emotional, she'd be like, oh, like, stop crying. Okay. I mean, she would. But she did. She spoke at a number of graduations and described how it worked. What was the chemistry after 7-plus decades?
Because he made me laugh. It's true, sometimes we laugh through our tears. But that shared laughter has been one of our strongest bonds.
Well, I mean, it is something. And look, this is the most powerful Republican family the last 50 years.
There'll never be another family like
this.
There's
no question. And so you think about the staying power of the Clintons or the Kennedys. I mean, you have to put the Bushes right there with President Bush's 50 years in public life, his father prior to him, and then obviously Jeb and George W. and George P., who's still on the rise. So,
he was
really
the president and the father of a president.
Rare. They really are like the closest thing, and arguably more successful politically
than the Kennedys.
Than the Kennedys.
Well, this is so. When she was a prude, and the first man she kissed was the last man she kissed.
Strange, isn't it?
Still staying with your story.
I've always felt I was the world's luckiest woman. Nobody ever had a greater, more precious family. Nobody ever had a better husband.
And then, it's a nice sentiment. I don't really want to think about Barbara Bush kissing people.
Okay. Well, they had 6 children. Of course, their daughter died when she was 3 from leukemia. I don't know if you saw the cartoon this weekend. It was the plane that he was shot down in. And there was a picture of Mr. Bush, President Bush, and Barbara Bush, and little Robin. And it says, now we're all together. Jenna Bush's granddaughter released that. So
it's a nice sentiment.
Yes. And he will be flown. His body will lie in state. This morning, Air Force One will be leaving Houston and taking him to Joint Andrews Air Force Base. And then he'll lie in state until Wednesday, until his funeral.
Right. And markets close on Wednesday, too, in honor of the National Day of Mourning as well.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Remembering President George Herbert Walker Bush, flags flying at half staff, as is appropriate.
For the next 30 days.
People, we got the day of mourning this Wednesday, December 5th, which will include the market closure in honor of George Herbert Walker Bush's life and presidency. That will be the National Day of Mourning. He'll lie in state until then. Now, just one of the lighter moments of and also now, some 25 years later, and it turns out to be a funny moment and an important moment. And this was the 1992 Christmas party at the White House after President Bush had lost his reelection campaign to Bill Clinton. And he invited Dana Carvey, who, of course, shot to stardom on Saturday Night Live in the 80s. And in that campaign in particular, not both for his impersonations of Bush and Perot. But, I mean, especially Bush. Dana Carvey was the best. And here's Dana Carvey at that Christmas party after he was summoned to come to the stage.
The way to do the president is to start out with Mr. Rogers. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Then you add a little John Wayne. Here we go. Let's go over the ridge. You put them together. You got George Herbert Walker Bush. That's the thing there.
And he was good. I mean, he made fun of him when he got sick. Remember, he was in Tokyo at that dinner.
Yeah.
Made fun of him for that. And then, but he was he loved it. HW. I mean, the whole time he was watching, then he was approaching the stage, and then he went back.
Well,
just was, and his buddies were coming up to him.
Well, he called Dana Carvey to come to the Christmas party, and this is President Bush on Dana Carvey and ridicule.
Dana's given me a lot of laughs. He said to me on the phone, "You sure you really want me to come there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I hope I've never crossed the line." And I knew exactly what he'd meant. And as far as I'm concerned, he never has. And the fact that we can laugh at each other is a very fundamental thing. I'm not sure on November 4th that the invitation would have gone out and been had the same enthusiasm, but we're shifting gears, and I think he's given us a wonderful kickoff to what I hope will be a joyous, totally friendly, very happy, somewhat nostalgic
Christmas. And it's just an interesting comment that he made about, I'm a public figure, essentially saying, I'm a public figure, supposed to be ridiculed, my mannerisms, the way I speak. Yeah. Thrown up on the on a Japanese dignitary's lap and all the, those events. Of course I'm going to be made fun of and stuff. But the way that Dana Carvey did it versus thinking about that versus the way it
that
happens
Alec
today.
Portrays President Trump.
Well, that's a good comparison.
Yeah.
And contrast. Yes.
Right. It was classier back then. And it wasn't so mean-spirited. I feel now that it's just nasty.
Right. And that I think that's the point that HW was making when he said, "Never cross the line." It's just so different. I mean, I think that interaction between Carvey and HW is just interesting to consider in terms of as compared to like the White House correspondence dinner today, and what
so
it's been
nasty.
Like over the last several years.
And they're not even going to have a comedian this year. A
couple of years, not several, because yeah. Obviously Obama was before then.
Well, and President Trump, you think he'd ever invite Alec Baldwin to the White House? No, that would not happen.
I don't think Alec Baldwin and Trump would have a Carvey H.W. Bush moment.
No, wouldn't happen.
It's really interesting, not just because it's fun to go back 25 years and see those and hear Dana Carvey do his impersonations again because he's the best, but just what a commentary it is and thinking about that is in context of today.
And I just can't get over H.W. Bush's resume. I mean, CIA director, ambassador for the U.N., chairman of the Republican Party. I mean, it goes on. Congressman, World War II aviator. I mean, it goes on and on and on. What he did, it's very impressive. I mean, he had a love of country and a devotion to family. When we were growing up, I thought, now that's a solid family man. That is somebody who you should aspire to try and marry.
Can you be a great American and a mediocre or even bad president? Because I would say that George Herbert Walker Bush was a great American, a patriot. Mm-hmm. I would say he was at best a mediocre president. And really despite his electoral success, really a mediocre political career. I mean, I'm just not on board. I'm all for being respectful. But, I mean, in terms of assessing his performance, not the man, not the family, and not the family man, assessing his performance in key positions, starting with being the president of the United States, I got to say, not that impressed. I mean, yes, he gets high marks for...
He drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, Operation Desert Storm.
He gets high marks for putting together the team and being the commander-in-chief of an excellent team that executed that war extremely well. He gets high marks for sort of... being a caretaker and facilitator to the end of the Cold War. But after that, it gets a little dicey for me.
Well,
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And speaking of Operation Desert Storm, Colin Powell was on the Sunday talk shows and talked about what his role was during that operation.
It was a shock to see what the Iraqis had done to take over this peaceful country to their south. And in the first couple of days after the invasion, President Bush was thinking it through. We gave him military options. We told him what the military could do. He was also anxious to see if there was not a diplomatic solution to this problem so that the Iraqis would simply leave Kuwait again. But by Sunday night after the invasion a couple of days earlier, when he was coming back from a meeting in Aspen, as he landed at the South Lawn and was walking into the White House, the press asked him, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And he just simply said, this will not stand, this invasion, this evil thing, words to that effect. And when he said that, I was at home listening and watching on television. I said, I know what my mission is going to be. If it isn't solved peacefully, we got to get ready to do it militarily.
And Dick Cheney, with Chris Wallace over the weekend, talked about the foreign policy team, the national security team that President Bush put together that orchestrated the removal of Saddam Hussein from Kuwait.
In terms of his leadership, important thing to remember, Chris, is what we put together during those years with Scowcroft at NSC and Jim at State, me at Defense, and then, of course, the President's Commander-in-Chief. We'd all worked together back during the Ford years. And it was, in my opinion, I'm probably biased, but about the most successful national security, foreign affairs, defense team that had been my experience to watch operate.
Bob in Buffalo Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan and Amy. I'm enjoying your insight with regards to reviewing Bush. People forget his policies begat Ross Perot, and I liked your comments about Ross Perot. Remember the giant sucking sound?
Yes.
But one thing I want to point out, Bush was a nice, gentle, polite president. After he lost, and it was pretty much a drumming when you think about it, he got a little only more than a third of the vote because Ross Perot got about 20% of the vote. But he went off into the background, not like our current loser in the past administration who has been attacking the current sitting president. Bush was just went off, and then he actually, if you know, befriended Clinton. Can you imagine Obama befriending Trump?
No, I cannot. Thanks for the call, Bob. And also provided an example for his son.
Right.
Who followed it.
But he said he never overstepped his boundaries. You know, he, in regards to offering him advice about the presidency, he let him, you know, chart his own path.
Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Pardon me if I don't get on the pity party to Kenny Bugport. I'm not going to be crying over my Perry topsiders. Worst president ever. Look at what
Why?
He really
Worst
did.
President
Why?
Ever.
Why, Mike? Why?
Worst president ever?
Well, let's see. He started that war, and oil prices tripled.
Well,
he,
Saddam Hussein argued
well, let me finish.
That war.
Okay, well, he also started NAFTA, put that in place, that Clinton picked up on. He was a corporate crony Republican who ran deficits to reward his friends in the banking industry. When he was vice president, he ran drugs in Mena, Arkansas, and the CIA used them. And when he was a CIA director, there's still people that say he was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. So this guy
oh,
was
Mike,
just a...
Mike, come on.
Mike, Mike, get a hold of yourself. I mean, really?
Economically, he practically ruined the country.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
The Kennedy assassination is a stretch.
We don't do conspiracy theories here. Particularly absurd. I mean, well... All conspiracy theories are somewhat absurd, but...
That's crazy.
I love the, some people say, because I don't want to have to own this conspiracy theory I'm about to unfurl. I mean, really. Get a grip. You can have a substance. Let's just focus on what we know to be true about the things that he did or did not do, as opposed to, I mean, honestly. This is interesting, though, since Mike brought it up. The divide in this country, too, that maybe bubble below the surface. And, frankly, President Obama was a bit of a revolt against this established order of Bush's and Clinton's. This post from Mays Jackson, our friend Mays Jackson,
yeah.
Over the weekend. You know, Mays Jackson, he does, he's on the air right now. He does the V103
right.
Morning show.
And he used to do it with Charles Thomas.
Yeah, and I like Mays. But... listen to this.
What do you do?
It's fascinating how these theories just don't die natural deaths in spite of the evidence or lack thereof. A message to the black ass lollipops. The guy from the CIA oversaw the delivery of cocaine to black communities and was rewarded with a presidency died last night. I'm sure in the era of Trump, we'll all forget that and sing his praises. Oh, yeah. And the longest running war in U.S. history. Yep, you guessed it. H.W. Bush. See, before I see all the black people thanking him for his service, think about how many black communities he was responsible for devastating. But, of course, Michelle Obama will be there to console her bestie, W, and you will all fawn over how touching it is. But while you were doing that, remember George H.W. Bush never loved you. Mae Jackson.
Is there something I don't know?
Well,
did something happened. I mean, he was CIA director for 1 year.
Yeah, sort of his Kanye moment there for Mae Jackson. I mean, difficult to know where to begin with that.
What do you mean that he responsible for handing out cocaine in black neighborhoods?
Well, this is the Louis Farrakhan conspiracy theory, right? That the crack is cocaine is a CIA conspiracy to eliminate the black people. I mean, it's put out there, and some people buy it and repurpose it, unfortunately. If anything, by the way, just a point of order, I mean, in terms of the facts, after the killing of Kiki Camarena, the DEA agent in Mexico in the late 80s, it was Reagan and even before that DEA agent was murdered by the Mexican cartel, it was Reagan and then Bush who escalated the drug war. Lee and Hammond, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, guys, you know, I hate to be a skunk at a picnic, but Bush Sr. was a one-term president for a reason. You know, no new taxes. And then I think the reason he was so gracious when he lost to Clinton was that they're two globalists cut right out of the same cloth.
Okay, thanks, Lee. By the way, with respect to Mae Jackson's statement that George H.W. Bush was responsible for devastating black communities, I guess I would agree with you in part, Mays. You know why?
Why?
Because after opposing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, H.W. Bush endorsed Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And there's nothing that's been more responsible for devastating inner city and poor communities than the Great Society entitlement programs. So I guess in the sense of him supporting those huge government social engineering programs, he was in part responsible. But so were all those Democrats, starting with Lyndon Johnson. Frank in St. Charles.
Hey, good morning. Do you think he could have did a better job advising his son about the Iraq war instead of just say, well, son, do whatever you feels best?
Well, that's a fair question, Frank. Thanks for the call. It was interesting because Cheney on Wallace's program over the weekend was asked about Bush Sr. sending Cheney a note, and I think W note, too, about Cheney, of course, his vice president and sort of the point man, if you would, on Gulf War II, that Cheney had become too much of a, what was that? I think, iron ass.
Oh, yeah.
He was too aggressive. It was too expansionist. It was too prodigious, the idea of nation building in the Middle East. So there was definite disagreement between Senior and Cheney Part 2 in Gulf War Part 2 with the approach that W and his administration took. So it is sort of interesting, although, again, Cheney and H.W. remained and good friends and retained their relationship to the end. But there was definitely a disagreement there. Jim in Tampa, Florida.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I called to say that there's a contrast in class between Bush, H.W. Bush, and McCain and the way that McCain went out. Impetuous. I think that same earlier caller referred to, would Obama befriend Bush? That sort of impetuosity wouldn't happen. But I have to say, I want to defend Mike from the North Side. He went a little over the line there, but Mike is the Dick Butkus of your callers. And we want him on our team.
Well,
and he's a great caller.
He's
really good.
Yes.
He's not going away anytime soon.
Thanks, Jim. Look, he's the founder of the LGBT party. Love guns, bacon, and Trump. So I don't want him to go away, but I am also not going to indulge ridiculous conspiracy theories about H.W. Bush's involvement in the Kennedy assassination. I think that's a fair compromise. Yeah.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
'Tis that time of year again. It's the giving season, and we've got a great opportunity for you. Our 2018 Food for the Poor campaign, with our goal of providing food for a year and water for life for 3,000 children in Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And Amy, why don't you tell our friends how they can help?
Well, we're asking for a one-time donation of $80. And with that, you'll provide food for a year and water for life for one child or adult in Haiti. We rely on you every year to push us over the goal line. And we do need your help. You guys are, you know, words are hard today and speaking is hard. Mm-hmm. It's like a gargled glass. Right. We thank you for your contributions.
Use your words.
Need more.
There you go.
Call 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673. We're asking for a one-time donation of $80, but if you can give $50, $40, any amount, we will so greatly appreciate. Or you can go to 560theanswer.com/food.
And then there's our business benefactor program. This is for our friends in the entrepreneurial community. $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor, and we provide you 40 60-second commercials that run primetime hours on these airwaves, Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the way you enroll in that program, like so many businesses have, American Eagle, out of Des Plaines, Matthew Hickey, attorney at law, Twin Supply in Oak Brook. Call our sales manager, Ann Jeanette, 847-472-8951. That's Ann Jeanette at 847-472-8951. You can join many businesses who are enrolled, like Signature Bank. And it's a way to get something from us as well to help promote your business. So it is a mutually beneficial relationship, and we would appreciate your support.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Let's take a little detour and visit the intersection of sports and the Me Too movement. We've done a bit of that in Chicago with Addison Russell, and he's back in the news. The Cubs tendering a contract to Addison Russell in the afternoon, the afternoon of the deadline to do so.
And he released a statement via the MLB network. Did you see that? I think I forwarded it to you, didn't I? On Friday, when he sent just that he's still working on himself. He apologized for what happened and is focusing on being a better man and continuing to play baseball.
He's got a 40-game suspension to start next year, but the bet is, and this is from Cubs Insider as well, the bet the Cubs are making is that even the injury-plagued version of Russell from last season is worth more than the $4.3 to $5.4 million he'll likely get in arbitration. So in the excuse that's made by this writer at Cubs Insider is this group action problem. You know, if we don't re-sign Addison Russell, then somebody else will. And he cites the case of the San Francisco 49ers linebacker Reuben Foster, who was cut by the 49ers the other week after he was arrested for allegedly beating his girlfriend. And then he was subsequently picked up by the Washington Redskins. Yeah. So, okay, and so that brings us to Kareem Hunt, who is the leading rusher in the NFL last year, Kansas City Chiefs. They're on a Super Bowl run right now, one of the best teams in the NFL.
And they won yesterday despite having him on the team.
Yeah, because they were fortunate to play the Raiders.
Exactly.
He had this incident back at the beginning of this year, February, in Cleveland, that now has come to light because there's video of it. Now, the Chiefs knew there was some sort of incident, and Kareem Hunt communicated with the Chiefs organization about this incident, but we didn't have the video until recently, and the video not only tells a story of abusive behavior by Kareem Hunt, it also gives lie to what Kareem Hunt told the Chiefs, and so the Chiefs caught Kareem Hunt.
Yeah, and it's a big deal. If you haven't seen the video, I'm sure you will. It's similar to the Ray Rice video, and people are comparing it, which is worse, Ray Rice or Kareem Hunt, but it's still bad. It shows this girl, this young lady, trying to get into his hotel room. He's got friends on the outside. There's some kind of altercation because there's no audio with it. And then he pushes his friend, which then returns. She falls down and hits the wall near the elevator bank. But then Kareem Hunt comes up and starts kicking her. And that's the problem. I mean, it just looked like a hot mess, but he did kick her a few times.
So he's this, you know, all-pro running back, and she's this 19-year-old girl, and he kicked her, I think it was once, but and then this was some melee. I mean, if you see the video, it's
That's
a mess.
Crazy.
People are trying to restrain her. They're trying to restrain him. She's on the ground after getting knocked down, as you said, and then he kicks her. So he's gone, but he's trying to resuscitate his career. And so he requested and got a sit-down interview with ESPN's Lisa Salter, at which he offered the following apology.
Honestly, I just want to let the world know, you know, how sorry I am for my actions. And, you know, it's been a tough time for me, and I'm extremely embarrassed because of that video. To be exact, it don't really matter what happened. I was in the wrong. I could have, you know, took responsibility and, you know, made the right decision to, you know, find a way to de-escalate the whole situation.
Well, I think it does matter, though.
It does matter to Lisa Salter what happened. She pressed him on what happened. So what was the deal?
Yeah, what happened?
You know, why did it escalate in the first place?
It was definitely some things that were said and did that I did not like, and that's not an excuse. It's not. I'm that person in that video did not deserve that. I didn't mean to hurt anybody or anything like that. It's really tough. It's tough because, like, I feel like I let a lot of people down, and I just really want to, you know, apologize to everybody, the Chiefs organization, my family, and close friends. Honestly, I never met the girl before besides that one time. I met her one time, and it was just kind of like my first 2 days living at this new place at the Nine in Cleveland, and kind of just had some friends over.
What were you arguing about in the hallway?
It was just a disagreement, and I honestly wanted her just to leave, but it's no excuse for me to act that way or to even, you know, put myself in that position.
He wouldn't get specific about the nature of their argument that led to the altercation that led to him behaving like a thug.
Oh, he said it was just a really long night.
Right.
So he lived in this hotel. He recently moved into the hotel. And she was not a guest at the hotel. She was going to one of his parties.
Right. He also admitted to lying to the Chiefs organization.
The Chiefs say that you were not truthful with them when you told them back in February about what happened. Were you?
The Chiefs are right. And I didn't tell them everything. And, you know, I don't, you know, blame them for anything. My actions caused this, and I really wish I could, you know, just apologize to them and let them know it's no hard feelings between me and the Chiefs. And, you know, I love the program, love the people there. And I just want to, you know, take this time and better myself and, you know, not let anything like this ever happen again.
So what do you think? I mean, Ray Rice's career was over when the video surfaced of him punching out his fiance, now wife, and
dragging her out of the elevator. That was awful.
Right. That was brutal. This is but just a difference in degree, not kind. Kicking her is still physical violence.
But he didn't push her down. He pushed his friend down, and his friend fell into her. That's how she hit the wall.
He kicked her.
But then when she, yeah, he kicked her in the leg, yeah.
Kicked her. So that's still physical violence. It's not as brutal as what Ray Rice did, but it's
also
still physical violence. So the question is, he's owning it. He's owning lying to the Chiefs. He's accepting being cut by the Chiefs. Should Kareem Hunt get a second chance? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Let me put it this way. Would you want the Bears to sign Kareem Hunt?
He's a lot younger and a better player than Ray Rice, so this is a completely different story. Well, I think their level of accomplishment is completely different. I mean, this kid's young. He's got his whole life ahead of him. Ray Rice was kind of on the way out. I mean, he was an older player.
Is that the basis on which the decision should be
made?
Well,
somebody, I mean, if I was an NFL owner, I'd pick him up in a heartbeat. Have you, you know, pay your penance, go out, speak it, you know, I mean, really own what you did. I didn't like at the beginning when he said, this has been a really tough time for me. Yeah, we understand that, but you don't start with that statement. If you have a representative, a PR person, you should say, first thing, I apologize to the victim, or just say, look, I messed up. I should have known better. And I'm not mature enough to make sound decisions, and I want you guys to forgive me because I want to play football again. But there wasn't that contrition. I mean, I know later on he said it was wrong. It was a long night.
I mean, he was asked if he could talk to the woman he kicked, what would he say? And he said he would apologize, and he apologized to her. So, yeah, I mean, not every word in the interview was on the mark, but generally speaking, I thought he expressed real contrition.
If you were an owner, you know, because you are in charge of some sporting teams, like the Blaine girls volleyball team, would you have him on your team?
Well, first of all, if I was an NFL owner, like you, I would also want Cameron Diaz to play me. She was so good in Any Given Sunday, wasn't she?
Riveting. Best performance of her career.
And like you, I would also want Al Pacino to portray me as a coach of an NFL football team.
If you're an owner.
If I was in the front office of the Bears, would I go try and sign Kareem Hunt?
Maybe for next season. Well, now for next season. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. You would do it.
What about to the Cubs extending an offer to Addison Russell? How does that set with you?
Oh, that's perfectly fine.
You don't have any problems with that?
No, because you know what? I really don't believe his estranged wife.
Well, that's the difference in that case,
there's
too.
There's no videotape.
Yeah,
these are,
so he said, she said.
Yeah, and they're going through a divorce. I mean, you say things, you do things out of character when you're grieving. So, oh, come on. You would just admit it, Dan. You would do it.
We got Jordan Howard. We got Ike Cohen. What do we need Kareem Hunt for?
Because now he's hungry to get back in there, and he's going to perform twice as good.
George in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, if Ray Rice and Kareem Hunt got to lose their jobs, why does Keith Ellison get a pass? He beat up two women, not one.
The voters said so. The voters gave him a pass. That's why.
You see, this goes back to H.W. Bush. He went into Somalia. We gave it over to the incompetent Clinton. We got Blackhawk down, and they got Minnesota. Now they got a wife a guy abuses two women, and he's the attorney general. Well, what's going on here?
Thanks for the call, George. I mean, so
well, there are allegations too.
Well, that's right with respect to Ellison, and the voters made their choice. So there was an opportunity to make a choice about Keith Ellison. The opportunity here with respect to pro sports teams is just this. I mean, it's just fan pressure, right? So how do you receive? Would you encourage a Bears front office to pick up Kareem Hunt? Do you support the Cubs front office extending a contract to Addison Russell? And I think one of the other things I'd say here, too, is these are case specific. So in terms of what's the policy and procedure I would have as an owner, depending on the facts. Obviously, you don't abuse people.
Yeah, but he lied about it, too. That stinks.
Well, that's right. And, you know, and all of these contracts have moral turpitude clauses. If you disgrace yourself and, by extension, the organization, then hit the road, Jack. I don't care how good you are. Character matters in any organization, including a sports franchise. What about that?
You want to know about Ray Rice? He's now an assistant football coach at his former high school. Good.
Joe in Franklin Park.
Hi. You know, the PR move for Kareem Hunt should have been when he went up there, apologized, and said, whoever picks me up, I'm going to play for it, and I'm going to donate every penny of my salary to battered women. His key is he's got to get back on the football field or he's going to be coaching high school football himself.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Joe. Well, that's interesting. I mean, it's you know, other people said this about Ray Rice. I wanted to give him a second chance. Say, hey, look, if his wife forgives him, his fiance, who he abused, then married, they got married. So if she forgives him, why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't we give him a second chance if the victim forgives him?
You know what he did to get that assistant coaching job? He volunteered for free for a year, and then they offered him a running back coach position. Mm-hmm. Good for him.
Mark on the South Side.
Morning, Dan and Amy.
Morning.
I think he deserves a second chance, but no organization will pick him up because they know the protest they'll get from the NOW organization and whoever else it may include. So they're not going to, they're just not going to allow it to happen. And with Addison Russell, there's no video. So you can, it's not as hard to take what Addison Russell did as what this guy did because we don't have a video of Addison Russell.
Well, that's right. Thanks for the call, Mark. But these aren't
the same allegation. I mean, hers was mostly he verbally abused her, she claims.
Well, but we have video of Kareem Hunt. We have an arrest of Reuben Foster. That's something. It's not dispositive of his guilt or innocence, but it's something. It's enough that the 49ers cut him and then the Redskins picked him up. So, I mean, my point is to say the threshold is we catch you red-handed. If we don't catch you red-handed, then we can wiggle off the hook and nobody will pay that much attention and everything's fine. If there's video, then there's a different standard because there's video, so I'm pressured to do it. So what's the actual moral stand? The moral stand can't be based on video evidence. It's got to be based on the underlying, well, all of the evidence, number one, and the underlying act, shouldn't it? Or just be based on how much public pressure I will get in a he said, she said context versus a video context. Well, that's not exactly a inspiring principle that you're laying down, is it? Joe in St. Charles.
Morning, guys. Great show.
Thank you.
I think the thing to keep focused on is at least we're keeping Pete Rose out of the Hall of Fame.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the call, Joe. Yeah, gambling on your own team out of the Hall of Fame. A related story, Neil deGrasse Tyson. You see this story? The acclaimed astrophysicist. He's got that show Cosmos on Fox. Two more women have come forward to accuse him of sexual misconduct. This after a graduate student last year accused Tyson of raping her when they were both when a musician last year accused Tyson of raping her when they were both graduate students. Bucknell University professor claims deGrasse Tyson groped her at an event in 2009. And another woman who worked for deGrasse Tyson claimed that she quit her job as his PA in response to repeated inappropriate sexual advances. Now, with respect to the PA, Tyson offered a response to all of these allegations. With respect to Professor Allers from Bucknell University, who claimed that Tyson groped her at an event in 2009. Here's what Tyson says. He stated he groped, this is a characterization, of course. He stated he groped, the alleged groping of Allers was an attempt to see whether a planetary tattoo on her arm that extended to her shoulder included Pluto. I got to remember that.
That's
line.
A good line. Hey, can you write that down? Line.
Yeah.
Put that in your phone for future use.
First of all,
Pluto's not a planet anymore.
Exactly.
Hello.
That's right. Secondly, that wasn't the problem. The problem was that when he followed up and wanted to see Uranus. No rim shot?
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Are you going to have a perfectly culturally Marxist Christmas? Calling James Finn Garner, where is he when you need him? The guy who wrote all those like PC holiday stories and PC bedtime stories, great little books. It's now difficult for him to write the parody because it's actually happening. For example, will you let your children watch the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer movie?
I watch that every year. Every year.
You know why?
Why can't I not watch Rudolph?
Because
the
you promote misogyny and bullying. You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen. Isn't it obvious?
Comet and Cupid. How is this and Donner and He's Blitz. The leader of the pack. He had the red nose. That's why he was in the front. That's why he was captain.
Coach.
He was captain. Put your best player out there.
I refer you to the authority beyond reproach, HuffPost, of course. Rudolph and the other reindeer laugh and call Rudolph names for having a red nose while preventing him from playing in any reindeer games. Bullies. Donner.
Yeah, but that catapulted
Blitzen,
his
could
career
you?
When they needed him to lead through the fog because of his red nose. So what they thought was funny and they made fun of him for was used in their advantage. To their advantage.
Rudolph's father verbally abuses him for making him wear a fake nose in order to gain acceptance.
Because he couldn't talk like me today.
It's not funny.
It's not funny, Dad.
Why do I have to wear this stupid nose?
HuffPo points out a scene where Rudolph's mom wants to join the reindeer husband, Donner, to search for their son after he runs away and goes missing. Donner replies, prepare yourself.
Yeah.
To Rudolph's mom, no, this is man's work.
Oh, I forgot about that.
No, no, no.
Honey, let's go find our baby. No, this is man's work.
And you're going to let your baby boys, Peyton and Eli, watch that kind of filth?
Come on, Dad. Let me play.
Rudolph's gone. Good riddance. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA. Turnkey.pro text line. All right. Next up. Baby, it's cold outside.
Baby, it is cold outside.
WDOK.
The boys do crew.
Pinky of the brain. WDOK in Cleveland, Ohio has pulled the Christmas song, Baby, It's Cold Outside. What's Light FM doing? Somebody find if Light FM has pulled Baby, It's Cold Outside, because I haven't.
I think I've heard that song on Light FM.
Oh, boy.
What? It's a great song.
I'm calling for Light FM's FCC license to be pulled today.
What could be wrong? I
really can't but stay. But baby, it's cold outside. I've got to go but away. Baby, it's cold outside. This evening has been hoping that you drop in. Nice. I'll hold your hands, they're just like ice.
Yeah. Thank you, WDOK, for leading the way. Baby, it's cold outside. I really can't stay, but baby, it's cold outside.
Well, he's trying to look at, you know, take after her best interest, because if she goes outside, she might freeze to death.
Say, what's in the drink? The answer is no, I got to get home. Can you say rape culture? Slipping her a Mickey?
Well, maybe it has some predatory undertones, but, I mean, he's just trying to be nice.
Yeah, sure. That's what they want you to believe.
Do you like that version or this version?
Okay.
What the hell is that?
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Baby.
I can't. I'm also banning Baby, It's Cold Outside, the Amy Jacobs and Bruce Wolf version from these airwaves. You're welcome.
At least I had a voice back then. I don't have one anymore. But yeah, I didn't know at the time that we were offending anybody.
There's, let's see here. Yeah, we've got some other things that should be banned. Let's join the cultural Marxist Christmas party. Kwanzaa. Holiday
party.
Winter solstice party. What are you doing for winter solstice? What else would you like to be banned so that you could enjoy your winter solstice more fully? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line, Cindy and Joliet.
Hey, good morning. Guess what? I saw Mommy kissing Santa Claus. She's a cheating. You know what? Get that hussy out of this house.
Well,
man.
Wait a second. No, no. Mommy should do whatever Mommy feels she wants to do to satisfy her desires. That's not. Thanks for the call. That's consistent with cultural Marxism.
But mommy's
feed my
appetite. Santa. Mommy's a ho, 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 ho. You can't be kissing Santa.
It's a lifestyle choice. Who are you to judge?
Oh, to have an open marriage with Santa.
I suppose Santa said to Mrs. Claus that this is women's work to deliver the presents. Maybe Santa should be banned. Mark in Plainfield.
Yeah, good morning, David. Amy, this also shows a sense of humor is in danger. Because the other day, Mark Levin was playing the parody to Winter Wonderland, walking around in women's underwear, and he played it because it's funny and amusing, and no one's going to accuse him of perverting sexual perversion because conservatives have a brain and can laugh when things are funny, even if it's a little off pace. Whereas these PC left-wing Marxists have no sense of humor and cannot laugh at anything.
Please, thanks for the call, Mark. Please never mention Mark Levin and women's underwear in the same sentence again. It's the holidays, after all. Drew and Morris.
Hey, how you doing, Dan? So when you were growing up in the 60s, you know, it was the right wing that was
You're talking to Amy now. growing up in the 60s.
Oh, my apologies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was the right that was square, you know? But now the left is so crazy that Rudolph is punk. I mean, what just happened there?
Right. Right. Thanks, Drew. James in Westmont.
The obvious, Frosty the Snowman. He was smoking up corncob pipe. Come on now. That's wrong. You should not. I think they changed it, though. Now he's juuling. Is that correct?
Well, what if he's vaping? Does that?
I think so. That's vape, what juuling is now, I believe.
Oh, yeah. J-J-U-U-L.
Yeah. 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 That, they call that vaping now.
But didn't the FDA come down on Juul?
Well, because they're targeting kids and they want to get rid of menthol flavored.
Thanks for the call, James. Yeah, we're going to have to take the pipe out of Frosty's mouth, that's for sure. Also, Frosty Frosty could say, because he's gender fluid, right? You can assign whatever anatomy you want to Frosty. So we just got to deal with the pipe. Bruce in Bloomingdale.
Okay, a couple things occurred to me while I was holding. We have to get rid of the lump of coal because it's environmentally incorrect.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'll tell you what, I'd like to give a few of these people a red nose and a black guy to go with it. It's Rudolph, for God's sake. Leave him alone.
Thanks for the call, Bruce. Yeah, they're picking on Rudolph for being picked on. They're trying to end Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer's career. Dennis and Crystal Lake.
Dan.
Oh boy.
I'll tell you what. Yeah. That's the reason I got rid of the warden. That women like being called broads in the 40s. Hello, Amy.
Yeah.
You were 20 years back doing this, and it led up to this. You almost came to the point where we could consider you part of us, but you blew it. You took Rudolph's nose away from him. You are a bum.
Thanks for the call, Dennis.
I didn't take away his nose.
No.
I just sound like him with his nose on today.
But you're a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer fan.
I love Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
And the movie.
I love it. Watch it every year, every Christmas.
Right.
That and that other, I can't remember. Words are hard today, Dan.
Are we able to watch It's a Wonderful Life? Does that need to be pulled? Does Frank Capra need to be sent to the gulag too? I don't know. I'm just trying to think about holiday staples. And obviously, Mr. Potter is portrayed properly evil. But I mean...
Someone ban that last year? They reimburse
everybody, but they're still running a bank, the Baileys.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that one. John in Westmont. In Wheaton.
Yeah, I mean, we got a real bad one with the Christmas story, the cultural appropriation of the Chinese at the end when they go to the restaurant.
A long luck.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah, good point. Thanks for the call, John.
I love that scene.
What about the
cuts the duck's neck off with a mullet. Boom. Remember that?
Excuse me. Before you even get to the Chinese restaurant scene, the naked lady lamp.
Oh, I have two of those.
That cannot stand.
I have two, not one.
That's objectifying women, Ms. Jacobson.
Fishnet nylons, that used to be hot, and it's not anymore.
Interesting piece that speaks to all of this insanity in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend from Lance Morrow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. America's addicted to outrage. Is there a cure? On the left, stay woke means stay outraged. And on the right-ish with Trumpians want to lock her up or build a wall. Outrage is reductive, easy to understand. It's an idiom of childhood. A throwback even to the terrible twos. Americans have lost tolerance for the 51% to 49% judgment call, even though that's about the margin of their disagreement on almost everything. A healthy society reserves this outrage for special occasions, Pearl Harbor or the church bombing in Birmingham. But in the 21st century, special occasions occur regularly. They have turned outrage into a ragged, all-purpose national reflex with side effects of disgust and despair. But the greatest casualty of outrage may be judgment itself. It's dangerous, writes Morrow, when indignation abstracts itself, as when charges of sexual misconduct become generalized in phrases like toxic masculinity, which may condemn all men regardless of facts. They're guilty one way or the other. If you cannot convict a man of rape, then you may get him for mansplaining. Outrage seems strenuous enough, but the truth is it's a lazy habit. Organizing a lynch mob is easier, with sure, immediate, and dramatic reward, than conducting a fair trial, which requires the brains and patience of an adult. Outrage may be justified, of course, and redress long overdue. Just as a dose of morphine may be appropriate to help a patient in extreme pain, so with outrage. But like morphine, outrage is widely abused and addictive. It may wind up becoming frivolous or fraudulent, as in all those triggers and microaggressions. Or, in this case, zeroing in on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and holiday staples with respect to music. So the dose matters, is the point, right? The dose matters. Outrage is appropriate in some instances, but being outraged at everything means being outraged at nothing. He also writes that it's gotten to be a racket. The coin of anger is debased. Indignation becomes a meme. It's a reflex, a kind of irresponsible play acting, or worse, a mania. When everyone is outraged, then real grievances lose their meaning, and the endless indulgence of outrage becomes objectively immoral. And that's where we're at now. That's where we're at now. And so you look at this as silliness, what we're talking about with Rudolph, we're talking about with banning Baby It's Cold Outside, but it's also Maoist. And so it's indicative of a real threat to a free society, assigning people to categories. It was the way of genocide in the 20th century, and it seems like we've learned very little from the 20th century, at least some of us. Steve in Mundelein.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if anybody thought about this one, but this one's pretty bad. We've been singing this since I was a kid. It's called I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. What are we trying to say?
Exactly. Thanks for the call, Steve.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, we've got some parody artists who've responded in kind to the Baby It's Cold Outside ban with...
What's the politically correct version of Baby It's Cold Outside?
Lydia and Josiah are their names.
I really can't stay.
Baby, I'm fine with that.
I've got to go away.
Baby, I'm cool with that.
This evening has been
hoping you get home
so very nice.
I'm glad you had a real good time.
My mother will start to worry.
Call her so she knows that you're
and
coming.
And father will be pacing the floor.
Better get your car home.
So really I'd better scurry.
Take your time.
Should I use the front or back door?
Which one are you pulling towards?
The neighbors might think
that you're a real nice girl.
Say, what is this drink?
Pomegranate LaCroix.
I wish I knew how.
Maybe I'll help you
to
out.
Break this spell.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I have to say no, no, no,
you
sir.
You reserve the right to say no.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
You reserve the right to say no.
I really can't stay.
Well, you don't have to.
Ah, but it's cold outside. I've got to get home.
You know how to get there from here.
Say, where is my coat?
I'll go and grab it, my dear.
You've really been grand.
We'll have to do this.
Yes,
again.
I agree.
How about the Cheesecake Factory?
We're bound to be talking tomorrow.
Text me at your earliest convenience.
At least I've been getting that vibe.
Lest I catch pneumonia and die.
I'll be on my way.
Thanks for the great night.
Bye.
Bye. Drive safe, please.
Don't watch that episode of Breaking Bad without me.
I won't. I'll save it for you.
That's pretty good. That's the best parody I've heard since that couple parodied Adele's Hello sign. Hello song and turned it into a song about food. Good stuff.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, remembering the life and presidential legacy of President George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41. That was, of course, the topic that dominated the weekend. We'll have a National Day of Mourning this Wednesday, December 5th. Markets will close. flags will remain at half staff for the next month.
Yeah, for the next month.
So some of the luminaries and Bush administration senior officials that made appearances over the weekend included his Secretary of State, but also his longtime friend, James Baker, who was with President Bush in the final moments, along with James Baker's wife. And here's how he described President Bush's final moments.
Yeah, he had a very gentle and peaceful passing, Chris. Only one of his children was living in Houston, Neil Bush. Neil and his wife Maria were there. My wife Susan and I, his rector from our church, St. Martin's Church in Houston. The doctor, some of the wonderful aides that took care of him in his later years. And it was a sweet situation. They made arrangements for all of his children to call in to, in effect, tell him goodbye. And his last words, the last words George Bush ever said were, "I love you." And he said those words to 43, George Bush, President George Bush, 43, who had called in to say, "Dad, I love you. I will see you on the other side." And President Bush said, "I love you," and those were his last words.
A president saying goodbye to a president, a father, son saying goodbye to his father. I mean, it's so beautiful.
Baker also said something also unique about those final moments. Irish tenor Ronan Tynan was there.
Another tender moment about that, Chris, was that the Irish tenor Ronan Tynan was in town. He'd come to town just to pay a courtesy call on President Bush, and he happened to be there, and he sang a couple of songs for President Bush on that last evening. And he sang, one of them was Silent Night, and as he was singing, President Bush was mouthing the words of Silent Night. He had a very gentle and easy passing, the kind we ought to all hope we have.
All right, appreciate those details, the last moments from James Baker. For more perspective on George Herbert Walker Bush's life and presidency, we're pleased to be joined by Jed Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, now a contributor to The Washington Times and The American Spectator. Jed, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
So your perspective on, you choose George H.W. Bush the man, George H.W. Bush the president.
Well, I don't think you can separate the two. And I think that's a very important point that we are kind of piling ourselves into here. Because George Bush, the president, was the product of George Bush, the man. The man was probably the final example of someone who was truly prepared to be president, someone who was truly competent to be president. He'd been a Navy war hero, a fighter bomber pilot. Mm-hmm. He'd gotten shot down once and crashed another time and was able to face death in his young age and was very able to deal with those crises. Later on, I mean, he was an ambassador to China. He was vice president. He was head of the CIA. I mean, this is the resume of a man who was, by education and experience, prepared to be president. Quite frankly, unlike anybody else who's come since. And I think we need to remember that context of George Bush in terms of, you know, how we go on as a nation. Do we want to have people who are, frankly, not prepared to be president, or do we want to have someone who, like George Bush, 41, was really someone who was ultimately prepared for the job, ultimately competent, and quite frankly, did a hell of a good job.
So how are you going to remember President Bush?
Well, I really don't have personal recollections of him. I was a political flunky in the Pentagon, and I was not exactly called by the president to conferences every day. But what I do remember about him was the inspiring way that he had, the effect he had on the people in the Pentagon. I was in the Pentagon during Desert Storm, and I will tell you, there were people there who were literally jumping through hoops to do what the president wanted because, A, they knew it was the right thing to do, and, B, because they really, really liked the man. You know, just as a, well, okay, you can talk about a various set of circumstances and all sorts of anecdotes, I remember when we first had Saddam Hussein invade Kuwait, the following morning, I walked into my next-door neighbor's office in the Pentagon. It was a Marine Brigadier General by the name of Tom Droughty. And he was just hanging up the phone and said, you know, walked in and said, "Hey, Tom, what's going on?" And he said, "I don't know, but that was the commandant on the phone. If we're going, I'm going with him." And, you know, of course, that's the kind of thing that you would expect from a Marine, but that's the kind of inspiration that George Bush had. And, you know, the things that we did during that war, I remember first few days of the war, a bunch of our armored vehicles were knocked out by friendly aircraft, our aircraft, because they couldn't see through the dust storms. And apparently General Schwarzkopf sent a short, gruff note back to Secretary of Defense Cheney to say, "Give me a fix for this." And 24 hours later, I had the one of the people who worked for my boss was DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. They're a bunch of insane geniuses that just kind of float around and, you know, you open the door once in a while and say, "Hey, what you got?" And they pop out with something weird. Anyway, the note got from Dick Cheney to DARPA, and from DARPA, 24 hours later, the head of DARPA, Dr. Vic Reese, was coming in to meet with the big guys, and he stopped in my office on the way. I knew him, and we'd done a lot of political stuff together. But anyway, Vic had in his hand what looked like a coffee can. I said, "What the hell is that?" He says, it's the answer to Schwarzkopf's problem. And what it was basically a high-intensity infrared emitter that had a piece of Velcro on one side. And what you did was you put Velcro on your tank or armored vehicle, you slap this coffee can-like thing on, you press the on button, and suddenly everybody in the sky can see good guy, good guy, good guy blinking. And you think about that. We went from Schwarzkopf having a note to say, "We need this fixed, we need this problem fixed," to within 24 hours, we had a working prototype. You know, that's the kind of thing that we did in the Pentagon back then. That's because George Bush was backing our play and we were backing his. And that's, you know, that's the story from those years.
Well, that may speak to this characterization from Dick Cheney over the weekend that he believes, and, you know, he's obviously got a bit of a biased view, but he believes that that George H.W. Bush National Security Foreign Policy Team with him and Scowcroft and Baker was the best in American history. What do you say to that?
Well, they're sure up there in the top three or four. You know, I worked for Cheney. He's a tough boss, a good guy, extremely smart guy. And again, not someone who would put up with a lot of nonsense and wanted to get the job done immediately. So, yeah, I mean, they may not have been the best. Frankly, I'm having a hard time thinking of anybody who was better. I know Don Rumsfeld, and probably his team was as good as any, and certainly as good as the Cheney team. But other than that, you know, I think Mr. Cheney, former Vice President, former Secretary of Defense Cheney, he's right. I think they were certainly among the best, and certainly in the top three at least.
And what do you think got lost from Gulf War I to Gulf War II, from Bush the elder to Bush the younger?
I think there was a real loss in terms of perspective. I think that going back, I mean, I was one of the people who very much supported and strongly supported the invasion of Iraq. Frankly, at this point, I wish I hadn't. I think we knew back then what we know now, and I certainly knew, and I wrote at the time. I wrote in, I think it was about 1st of April of 2003, just before we went into Iraq. I said, we cannot do nation building because it will not work in a Muslim country. And I've proven that myself right. I mean, it's not rocket science, guys. But when Bush 43 was campaigning, he said, we can't do nation building. That's the first thing he went in and did. And we've been stuck in Iraq and Afghanistan building nations and losing American lives for 17 years. It just can't work, doesn't work. And I think the perspective that Bush 41 had was lost by the time his son was president.
Now, with the passing of President H.W. Bush, it kind of overshadowed what happened at the G20 summit. We have a new NAFTA agreement. But also, what do you make of this temporary truce in the trade war with China?
Well, it's a good thing. I'm not a big favor of tariffs and non-tariff barriers to trade. You know, I'm not exactly the most strong free trader, frankly, because I don't know a hell of a lot about economics. You know me, guys. I'm a bullets and bombs guy. But the fact of the matter is, I think not jumping off and launching a huge trade war with China, it's got to be a pretty good idea. I mean, we just need to take our time a little bit and see what we can work out. Sure, the Chinese are doing an awful lot of unfair trade practices, and worse, their capture of intellectual property from the United States by their own cyber espionage and everything else they can think of has just got to stop, because they're stealing everything we invent. And, you know, they're pretty good at taking it and turning it to their own uses. So, you know, if that's not going to stop, China has to be punished somehow. And the only way we have to punish them at this point is through trade. That hurts us. It hurts them. And quite frankly, I'm hopeful we can find a way around it without getting into a big trade war.
Sticking with the G20, how did you interpret that high five between Putin and MBS?
Hey, birds of a feather, man.
Yeah. Mutual Admiration, you know, Society, that's it?
Oh, yeah. Look, this is MBS is not a good guy. We know that. We knew that from the very first minute he came to power. Not that anybody else was in Saudi Arabia would be a whole lot better, because, you know, they are Islamists and follow a sect of radical Islam that is never going to allow us to be able to fully coexist with them or trust them. But I think he and Putin recognize in each other the kind of autocrat, the kind of dictator, the kind of totalitarian that they can identify with. And, you know, that also is a big signal to us that if we, for example, MBS wants to build nuclear power plants right now, if we don't do it, I mean, you can bet that Putin will be there in within 24 hours to do it. And we'll gain all of the advantages and power over the Saudis that we now have, or at least think we have.
Now, General Mattis, over the weekend at the Reagan National Defense Forum, interviewed by Brett Baer from Fox, said, look, we don't have a smoking gun that MBS ordered the murder of Khashoggi. And so he just kind of said that matter-of-factly and sort of moved on to effectively reaffirm the president's position with respect to the Saudis, even while there's a bit of an uprising in Congress. Where do you come down with respect to the president's handling of that?
Well, I think at this point we have to take a deep breath. You know, it's inconceivable to me that MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, that he did not either directly order the murder or at least acquiesce in it and have knowledge of it. It's inconceivable that in a government like Saudi Arabia, that would happen without his knowledge or approval. Mm-hmm. Having said that, what we can do at this point is not at all clear to me. We can at least tell the Saudis that we believe MBS is dispensable, that he is an obstacle to our alliance, and they can take it from there. Look, it would not be unheard of for his father, the king, to change his mind and say, you're not crown prince anymore. Or for more drastic things. I mean, you can have assassinations in Saudi Arabia are not that uncommon. Even a king was murdered in 1975, I believe it was. So, you know, there's a lot of things we can do, and we ought to be telling the Saudis that this guy is not someone we can trust, and that they ought to do something to get him out of power.
He is Jed Bamman, former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to the Washington Times and the American Spectator. Jed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dana and Amy, and the one thing Saturday Night Live does consistently well, parody Joica, and they did again this weekend. Perfect timing, with their nuptials behind them.
Oh yeah,
SNL.
They couldn't get their hands off each other.
Morning Joe. This is the best. This is the best thing they do, just parody them in heat.
Yep. That's right, gang. She made an honest man out of moi.
Stop it. Please,
no more
stop
living
it.
In sin for this guy.
Oh, were we living in sin? You want to confess your sins?
Maybe I do. I've had impure thoughts.
Wow. Maybe you need to say 5 Hail Mikas.
Oh. With pleasure.
And he points to her body in 5 different places. But then they went on to interview, you know, AOC, the newest, hottest member of Congress.
Well, I'm a millennial, so getting any full-time job is overcoming incredible odds. I'm actually still working for TaskRabbit.
Ooh, a second job. You're going to be pretty busy, Alexandria. You know, I was in Congress.
He wants to.
And trust me, it's tough over there.
Joe, I worked as a bartender in a Mexican restaurant like 11 minutes ago. This job is a frickin' breeze. We get Saturday and Sunday off. I can sit down whenever I want. Changing America's healthcare system is gonna be nada.
I correct myself. Actually, SNL's parody of the two of them as, you know, vapid, cool kids is even better than the portrayal of them in Heat, but it's good stuff.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Remembering Bush 41, one of the more memorable moments was after he lost the presidential election in 1992, the Christmas party at the White House, his final one. And he invites Dana Carvey.
That's so awesome.
Of course.
He was on C-SPAN, the whole thing, 20 minutes long.
Made his mark in part on parroting, impersonating Bush, and in the 1992 cycle, Bush and Perot. And Dana Carvey took to the dais to explain how you do a George Herbert Walker Bush impersonation.
The way to do the president is to start out with Mr. Rogers. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Then you add a little John Wayne. Here we go. Let's go over the ridge. You put them together. You got George Herbert Walker Bush. That's the thing there.
Wouldn't be prudent at this juncture.
And
he had all the hand gestures down. He's like, there, and, you know, the hitchhiker one.
1,000 points.
Thousand points. Yep.
Yeah.
But I mean, great. I just in
bar
this,
all there. Bar. I mean,
in this day and age, you would never have President Trump invite Alec Baldwin to the White House for anything, let alone a Christmas party to make fun of him.
No,
that would not be tolerated.
And H.W. sort of made that point and really provided some foreshadowing of where this was going to go, different than what it was during his time.
Dan has given me a lot of laughs. He said to me on the phone, "You sure you really want me to come there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I hope I've never crossed the line." And I knew exactly what he meant. And as far as I'm concerned, he never has. And the fact that we can laugh at each other is a very fundamental thing. I'm not sure on November 4th that the invitation would have gone out and been had the same enthusiasm, but we're shifting gears, and I think he's given us a wonderful kickoff to what I hope will be a joyous, totally friendly, very happy, somewhat nostalgic.
Talking about Christmas, and it's a couple things President Bush said there. One, just the idea that you have to be open to ridicule, you laugh at yourself, an appreciation for Dana Carvey's comedic skills and a recognition that it wasn't vitriolic. But the second thing is just the ability and the freedom to laugh, to parody, to ridicule. I mean, that's part of a free society. And that's certainly increasingly under assault from the cultural Marxist left.
President Bush's last public act came last month when he voted. And I don't know if you saw, he was, you know, in his wheelchair wearing his signature socks, and he had his service dog, Sully, next to him, who, by the way, is now going to go back to Walter Reed Hospital, but he's had Sully since June, since the passing of his wife, Barbara.
There's also something else I want to make sure we mention again, post-presidency 41. The note he left Bill Clinton on the day Bill Clinton entered the Oval Office, January 23rd, 1993, the key line, your success now is our country's success. I'm rooting hard for you. The relationship you developed with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, they teamed up to help, you know, global relief efforts.
But how different it was, the lesson that 41 set for 43 not necessarily, it was adopted by 43 in terms of post-presidency, not so much by 42 or 44. Maureen Dowd writing the New York Times this weekend, curtains for the Clintons. I mean, brutal. Brutal. But largely true. What is the point? She talks about going to Toronto to an event with Bill and Hillary Clinton. The hockey rink is half curtained off, but even with that, organizers are scrambling at the last minute to cordon off more sections behind thick black curtains due to lack of sales for the event. And she contrasted, of course, with Michelle Obama's, you know, wildly successful book tour. But
19,000 people in Brooklyn.
But she asked, what is the point? What are the Clintons doing? It's not inspirational. It's not for charity. They're not raising awareness about a cause. They're only raising awareness about the Clintons.
Yeah, and they're lining their own pockets.
But it can't be the money at this point, number one. They're not making as much. But also, they've hoovered, writes Dowd, more than $2 billion in contributions to their campaigns, foundation, and philanthropies.
$2 billion?
After the White House, the money grubbing raged on, with the Clintons making more than 700 speeches in a 15-year period, blithely unconcerned with any appearance of avarice or of shady special interests and foreign countries buying influence. They stockpiled a whopping $240 million. Even leading up to the 2016 presidential run, Hillary was packing in the speeches, talking to the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, the American Camp Association, eBay, and, of course, the trifecta of speeches for Goldman Sachs worth $675,000. And then this quote, which applies to the Clintons particularly, but the left generally, and it comes from a liberal, Charlie Peters, the former editor of the Washington Monthly. What scares me most is Hillary's smug certainty of her own virtue as she has become greedy, and how typical that is of so many chic liberals who seem unaware of their own greed. How different the post-presidency for Clintons, the Clintons have been, as compared to the post-presidencies of both Bushes. I think that's something that's worth distinguishing. For more insights on these topics and more, we're pleased to be joined by best-selling author Ronald Kessler, New York Times best-selling author of books on the Secret Service, the FBI, the CIA, and his most recent offering, The Trump White House Changing the Rules of the Game. Ronald Kessler, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What about your reflections on H.W. Bush, both his presidency and post-presidency?
Well, in my book, The First Family Detail about the Secret Service, I have a whole chapter on Bush and how he treated Secret Service agents with respect and consideration, in contrast to someone like Hillary, who's still under Secret Service protection, who is so nasty to her agents that being assigned to her detail is considered a form of punishment and the worst assignment in the Secret Service. I have a number of anecdotes, one of which is when Bush was vice president, the Secret Service agents would come out at 3 in the morning looking for the cookies that the stewards would make. So one of the agents, Albrecht, was looking for the cookies, and he heard this voice behind him, where are the cookies? Well, he turned around. It was George H.W. Bush. And so the two of them went looking for the cookies, finally found them, ate them together with milk, and just a touching example of how Bush interacted with other people.
Did any of your agents describe the relationship and the love between H.W. Bush and his wife, Barbara?
Yeah, I was just going to say that they had a very, very close, loving relationship. Barbara also was very considerate of her agents. One time they were kind of dunked poor. It was freezing out. One of the agents had not brought a hat, and Barbara insisted that they go back to the house and get one of Bush's hats. And the agent said, no, that's not necessary. And Bush said, well, you better do what Barbara says. So also a big contrast with Al Gore, who was Bush's predecessor as vice president. Gore also is one of these people like Hillary who claimed to be a champion of little people, but yet he couldn't bear to even say Merry Christmas to them when they were out there guarding his property in Tennessee. Tremendous hypocrisy. And speaking of hypocrisy, I have a recent Washington Times op-ed on the dishonest media, the fact that Trump, when he said that California needs to do better forest management, was denounced in the media as just a shameful person and just could not be more heartless. Well, it turned out subsequently that Governor Jerry Brown, a Democrat, as you know, said the same thing, that they need better forest management. In fact, he had already been moving in that direction. But, of course, the media never apologized or corrected the record on that issue.
Well, going back to H.W. Bush, Brett Baer writing an op-ed, Dana Perino an op-ed. Baer and her both get to the same point, which I think you're getting to, is that politics aside, Bush's legacy is his humanity, his decency. He treated people well, and even though he was a person who came from privilege, it didn't radiate from him the way it does from some of the champagne socialists you're talking about.
Yeah, and that example that the New York Times ran in his obit of him seeming to be amazed at a grocery scanner was completely a fabrication.
Yeah,
He was simply looking at how this latest version can figure out labels, even if they're torn up, even if they're disheveled. So, totally a fiction. You know, during Watergate, I sat next to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. Later, I joined Woodward's investigative team at his invitation. And I know the pressure we were all under the executive editor, Ben Bradley, to be fair and accurate. And any of us would have been fired over the stories that are run now. For example, the New York Times ran a story, the lead was that Rowan Brewer, a model, had barely met Donald Trump in Mar-a-Lago when he asked if she wanted to change out of her clothes. Well, wow. It turned out that she had been invited at the last minute to a pool party at Mar-a-Lago. She didn't have time to go back and get a bathing suit. He asked her if she wanted one, and he gave her one. She went in the bathroom, changed, came out. And guess what? The story portrayed this as some demeaning encounter, but in fact, she started dating him and went out with him for several months. Where did that appear in the story? In the 16th paragraph. That's just such a stunning example of the dishonesty of the media.
Yeah, I listened to Sam Donaldson over the weekend. He was on CNN and saying the media now is different than the media back then. Back then, they're held to different standards, and President H.W. Bush knew that.
Yeah. You know, for example, when April Ryan, CNN contributor and radio network reporter, said at a White House briefing that Sarah Sanders must have made up the story that she baked a pecan pie. She insinuated publicly that this was a lie based on nothing, no evidence whatsoever. That person would have been fired immediately back then. And now she goes on CNN all the time pontificating about Trump.
And it's also there was a big story over the weekend that NPR got wrong, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, even though they don't deserve it. But this is with respect to the Cohen plea last week and the report that NPR published. Trump Jr., Donald Trump Jr.'s 2017 testimony conflicts with Cohen's account of Russian talks, which would be big news, except it's not true. And somebody pointed out on Twitter, I think from Daily Caller, once you see the transcript, which NPR had, it's really, really hard to see how this happened, this mistake they made. The entire premise of the story was false. And so NPR issues this correction, admitting they mischaracterized an answer Trump Jr. gave to the Senate investigators. But, I mean, the premise of the story is wrong. And so the whole thing is wrong. And this was NPR, not CNN.
You know, in this op-ed, I quote former National Public Radio CEO Ken Stern as saying that the liberal media bias is pervasive and all of it runs counter to President Trump. When you're a liberal and everyone else around you is as well, it is easy to fall into groupthink on what stories are important, what sources are legitimate, and what the narrative of the day will be. And you know, somehow that, you know, is an attempt to explain what you're talking about. But I don't think any of us can explain it except that it's just dishonesty. That, you know, to me, these people are scam artists posing as journalists. I would, you know, it's akin to robbing a bank. It's not criminal, but it's just as dishonest. And you see it every single day in the media. And another example recently was that Trump was denounced again as being heartless when he said that when he used tear gas under his administration against the caravan in trying to cross into the southern border.
Right.
Well, it turned out that the Obama administration had used tear gas 79 times, not once as under Trump, but 79 times. There was never an outcry under Obama, and there were no stories pointing that out when Trump was denounced as being heartless.
Everything about the D.C. press corps coverage of the caravan, including the composition of it, Saturday with a convicted murderer arrested who was trying to sneak back into this country as part of the caravan. So, I mean, you know, it's gone from Michael Wolff's, if it sounds true, it probably is, to if you wish it were true, then it is, seems to be the standard for the D.C. press corps.
You got it. You know, during the campaign, the press portrayed Trump as a failure, as broke. Then after he won, all of a sudden he was portrayed as being so wealthy that his tentacles were all over the world. No matter what he did, it was some kind of conflict of interest. The stories were run claiming that Trump was simply using money from his father after his father died. Well, it turned out that in 1999, when his father died, Trump was already worth $1.9 billion, according to Forbes. That's just a fact. But, of course, they ignored that.
Yeah,
it's endless.
We could share these stories all morning long. He is Ronald Kessler, New York Times bestselling author. Books on the Secret Service, the FBI, CIA, and the new one, The Trump White House, Changing the Rules of the Game. Ronald Kessler, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
We'd like to thank Matthew Hickey Law of Chicago, Twin Supplies Company of Oak Brook, Signature Bank, Palatine Complete Dental, Cafe Salsa, just some of our business benefactors.
Yeah, and American Eagle. And what they did, they're helping others this holiday season. They're making a one-time tax-deductible donation of $2,500. The money goes to food for the poor to feed those less fortunate this holiday season. And as a way of saying thank you, we'll give them 40 60-second commercials that will air primetime right here on AM 560 to become a business benefactor. And you're going to want to do this. Call Ann Jeanette right now. Her number is 847-472-8951. She'll answer any of your questions. It's really the best way to get your company out there, to take your business to the next level. If you've thought about advertising, this is the time to act. And we thank you in advance. We also want to thank AmericanEagle.com. They're on the business benefactor list, too.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Your grade for President George Herbert Walker Bush's presidency. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. His Veep, Dan Quayle. Murphy Brown's back on TV. Dan Quayle's back to relevancy. No, obviously that's the passing of his president. Yeah. But
I think he's aged very well. You said you remember him as 45 years old, a young, spry.
Well, yeah. I mean, at 45, I think when he left the White House, I think he's 46, maybe he's 41. I mean, so you just, I don't know, for some reason he just is frozen in time in my memory. So to see him with Maria Bartiromo over the weekend at 71.
Hair. He looks great.
I know. It's just weird to think about him being 71.
That means.
And it tells me how old you are.
No, how old you are.
No, you.
You.
Dan Quayle on how he'll reflect on President Bush's legacy, political legacy as president.
George Bush was... He was just absolutely the best. He was a great individual, in my opinion, a great president. He loved his family. He loved his work. He loved the country. And it was such an honor for me to work with him every single day that he was president. I was vice president for the American people. And a lot of folks, you know, they ask me, well, what's the legacy? I said, you know, that's a tough question. Historians will sort that out. But in my view, his legacy, Maria, was accomplishments. He got things done. When he left office, the economy was growing at 5-6%. You know, the Berlin Wall came down. Eastern and Central Europe freed from the yoke of communism. Apartheid in South Africa was eliminated. Success in putting Saddam Hussein back into Iraq. Noriega apprehended. So many things in a short period of time. And the domestic front as well. So, accomplishments. He did so much in 4 years.
You agree with Quayle? I mean, I think some of the stuff, you know, what happens on my watch, I get credit for. The idea of ascribing the end of apartheid in South Africa to George Herbert Walker Bush is a little bit of a stretch
for
me.
Well, what about the fall of the Berlin Wall?
Well, that's a little bit of a stretch, too. I mean, he's presided over the end of the Cold War.
Right.
He was part of the administration that deserves the most credit for precipitating that end, the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
So he gets some credit for it, I agree. But on balance, I mean, particularly on the domestic policy front, I'd say he was pretty mediocre at best. He was sort of establishment, government-centric Republican. And that's just my particular cup of tea. It's not to say he wasn't a decent man, he wasn't a good family man, but we're just talking about him as president here, and I would give him probably a gentleman C as president.
Really? I mean, he was disciplined, but I thought he always towed the party line. And I always trusted him, and I thought that he was relatable to people. He served his country and had devotion to his family. And he served the country by being a World War II aviator and surviving being shot down. Well, I mean,
I understand. We're talking about his presidency, though.
All right, well.
I understand, and I respect his service to the country, his heroism.
He could have easily. I mean, right when he turned 18, he went to war.
Yes.
As soon as he could.
Correct.
And that is so admirable.
Yes.
Because men aren't made like that anymore.
All of that's true, but it sort of prompts the question, can you be a patriot? Can you have done wonderful things in one space, not just in terms of accomplishments, but for your fellow man, and turn out to be a mediocre president of the United States? I think you can. And I think George Herbert Walker Bush was. I mean, do you forgive him for his read my lips, no new taxes? Some of the other regulatory onslaught that was ushered in during his time. Really the beginning of weaponizing, or further weaponizing the EPA. I don't know. I mean, remember... he signed on, did George Herbert Walker Bush, at the time, to Lyndon Johnson's Great Society entitlement programs. So, you know, it's this idea of government being a force for good. And George Herbert Walker Bush believed it was. And his son believed it was. That's what compassionate conservatism was. Government being government as compassion, as a compassionate service provider. Okay, yes, people should do things with compassion, and that includes the public sector agencies. But the philosophy is important because it tells you where somebody's going to go or what they'll be susceptible to doing, the siren song of the left. And both Bushes were susceptible to purveyors of big government. Bush 41 with Great Society, three decades before he was president of the United States, and Bush 43, Medicare Part D, new entitlement program. I mean, it's just important to sort of learn the lessons of history, I think. And I think President George Herbert Walker Bush never got over, and I don't think I heard anybody say this, but making up for opposing the Civil Rights Act, making up for denouncing Medicare at the outset before he bought on to all of the big government social engineering programs ushered in by the Great Society. He was opposed to the public accommodations provisions of the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. The law might protect 14% of the people, but I'm equally concerned about the other 86%. Talking about, you know, separate but equal, separate drinking fountains, separate bathrooms. So he was wrong about that. And I just wonder if sort of a guilty conscience played into his move. A guilty conscience combined with political opportunism. I've got to change if I want to be successful politically. So sometimes that forces you to make proper changes, and sometimes it leads you down a primrose path. Certainly a proper change with respect to the civil rights culture, the end of Jim Crow. But on some of these other matters, I would argue not so much. Sean in Elmwood Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
George Bush is single-handedly the reason to always reject collectivism and social engineering government because he embodies the definition of good intentions gone bad. You gave him a C because you feel bad for him. He's an F and a strong F. That doesn't mean he's a bad person. He was a good person, but he was a failure. And he didn't understand that the only real compassion you can have for somebody is to give them their unalienable rights even when you don't like the outcome. He is the main reason we are in this quagmire in the Middle East. And he is the originator of wrapping your arms around these inbreds with tablecloths on their head, the Saudis. I give him no quarter. He is an F. May he rest in peace, and I wouldn't mind it too bad if he burned in hell.
Sean, come on, stop it.
Sean. Thanks for the
Such
call.
Such an alarmist. Grow up.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, shut your mouth.
You can assess his performance without wishing eternal damnation. I mean, just a little bit of restraint.
You talk about dad. How do you think Jeb Bush feels today?
I love my dad. I'd kill for him. I'd go to prison for him because I love him so much.
Yeah, that's the classic from the 2016 campaign.
Just cool your heels.
Well, right. And the other thing about the quagmire of the Middle East was complicated well before George Herbert Walker Bush was president. It remains so. His execution as commander-in-chief of Gulf War I, difficult to argue with. High marks for that. And also, it's noteworthy, and Cheney recounted this over the weekend on Wallace's show, that H.W. Bush was not on board with the prodigious agenda of Gulf War II when it came to nation building. In point of fact, he had a pointed disagreement with Cheney over just exactly what they were taking up, the scope of it. So, there were skills that George H.W. Bush had, particularly in the national security and foreign policy spaces. But on the domestic side, he was somebody that called supply-side economics voodoo economics when he ran. He proved it by dealing away principle on his promise not to raise taxes. And I understand the context is important, and he had to do a deal with the Democrats, and he had to get support for the authorization of use and force in Kuwait against Saddam Hussein. But I think that did irreparable harm to his presidency, particularly when you take it in total, the sort of disinterest in entitlements and so the debts and deficits that Ross Perot ran on, the where the economy was prior to his defeat at least perceived to be, and how he messaged on those topics, because he wasn't a supply sider. He was a government as a force for good, government as a force multiplier for economic growth. I just think he was wrong on those areas, and he made terrible policy choices. And he was still a war hero and a patriot. It's a difficult, I think, dichotomy for a lot of people to wrap their heads around, because you want somebody to be unequivocally this or unequivocally that, and he wasn't. He was a great man, great family man. He presided as the, well, not the patriarch, but certainly extended the dominance of the Bush family in Republican Party politics for 70 years.
Yeah.
Picking up the mantle from his father. No small feats.
No.
And but it doesn't mean he was a great president.
All right. And then people, you know, ridiculed him for going to Houston and jumping in and becoming part of the oil boom. But he was Houston. He was Texas. One of the funniest things, he had a family reunion. And since I lived in El Paso, it was majority, where most of the people were Hispanic, Dan. One time they had a family reunion. He said, I'll kick the grandkids, even them brown ones, too. He was joking around because he's a jokester.
Yeah, right.
And people were up in arms in El Paso. Like, how could he do that? That's racist. It's like, no, he's just joking around. He has a sense of humor.
Well, and with respect to the whole he made his money in oil in West Texas, he did. Yeah. But he could have done nothing and been a multimillionaire and had an easy life. Remember, his father, Prescott Bush, was a partner at Brown Brothers Harriman, the Wall Street investment house, whose partners included Robert Lovett, a future Secretary of Defense. So he was born into privilege. George H.W. Bush was always going to be all right. But he chose to enlist in the Navy and go fight in World War II rather than go directly to Yale and pass World War II. He chose to make his own way, again, with connects to underwrite the startup of his oil business, but nonetheless, make his own way in the oil business in West Texas rather than just sit home in Connecticut or become a Wall Street financier just reap the transaction costs from all the family friends. There is a aspect of H.W. Bush not taking the easy path that was provided to him, and I think that commands some respect, too.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.